Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Salon columnist Heather Digby Parton, who urges floundering Democrats to embrace FDR New Deal-style populist economic policies that change people's lives. Tabitha Sudeo, executive director of Connecticut Students for a Dream, who talks about the effort to build bridges between diverse immigrant communities facing abduction and deportation by the Trump regime. And Dr. Farrick Fong, professor of laboratory medicine, pathology, and microbiology at the University of Washington, who discusses the deadly consequences of Trump HHS Secretary RFK Jr.'s cut of all federal mRNA vaccine research. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A Guardian investigation reports 1,500 civilians were killed in an April attack on Sudan's massive Zamzam displacement camp by the rebel Rapid Support Forces. It was the single most deadly massacre in Sudan's two-year-long bloody civil war. The three-day assault ended in the RSF gaining control of the huge Zamzam camp, where 500,000 people have taken refuge from the war in northern Darfur. Guardian reporters collected testimonies of mass executions and large-scale abductions as hundreds of civilians from the camp remain unaccounted for. Last month, the International Criminal Court said it had reasonable grounds to conclude that war crimes and crimes against humanity were being committed in Darfur. An atrocity expert declared that the levels of violence were striking even when viewed alongside the genocidal slaughter of ethnic African groups in Darfur during the 2000s by the Arab militias who would later become the RSF. The war between the Arab-led RSF and Sudanese army, which broke out in April 2023, has seen repeated atrocities, forcing millions from their homes and causing one of the world's most serious humanitarian crises. The Trump administration is developing a powerful data tool it claims will let states identify non-citizens registered to vote. But Democratic critics, data experts, and democracy defenders warn this database could allow the federal government to collect vast quantities of information on American voters for unclear purposes. Stateline News reports some Democratic election officials and opponents of the effort fear President Trump wants to build a federal database of voters in order to target his political opponents or cherry-pick rare examples of non-citizen voters to justify further suppression of Trump and Republican Party opponents. The Trump regime is attempting to make changes to the 1986 Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlements, or the SAVE program. At the same time, the Department of Justice is asking states for copies of the voter rolls. Trump's effort to have Congress pass a national proof of citizenship voter registration requirement has stalled, and his executive order to do the same has been halted by the courts. The citizenship data tool may offer a backdoor way for the regime to accomplish an identical goal. If Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist, is elected mayor of New York City this November, his toughest job may be to reform the 35,000-member New York Police Department while maintaining control of the political narrative around crime and public safety. New York City's last progressive mayor, Bill de Blasio, retreated from confrontations with an aggressive police union and took months to deal with the fallout from the police killing of Eric Garner, who died in an illegal chokehold by police officers. Already, Mamdani has faced blowback for his past criticism of police violence, and his proposal to create a new Department of Community Safety to hire civilians to address a range of issues currently handled by police including enhancing subway safety, hate crimes, mental health, homelessness, and violence in high-crime neighborhoods. Mamdani faces media and economic elites' pressure to retain current police commissioner Jessica Tisch, seen as loyal to the NYPD culture and status quo. But The Nation magazine urges Mamdani to pick his own commissioner, loyal to him and his agenda. Given that the police unions, media, Wall Street, and the city's real estate interests are planning to wage perpetual war against him, no matter what he does. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The United States is now in the midst of the most serious attack on the nation's democratic institutions, rule of law, and checks and balances on executive power in modern presidential history. Every day, Donald Trump and his authoritarian regime are violating constitutional norms, civil and human rights, as he embraces dictatorial powers and threatens the use of political violence against his perceived enemies. Even as Trump moves forward to deploy the U.S. military to occupy minority-majority cities, signaling the future invocation of the Insurrection Act and the imposition of martial law, there's been little or no effective pushback by federal courts, and mostly green lights, from the fascist-friendly extremist right-wing majority of justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. Despite Trump's plummeting approval ratings in recent public opinion polls, the Democratic Party has seen its lowest favorability rating at 32% in nearly 30 years. Much of the anger directed at Democrats comes from their anemic and uninspired effort to fight against Trump's authoritarian, racist, and cruel policies targeting America's working families and most vulnerable population. Your reporter spoke with Salon columnist Heather Digby Parton, who urges floundering Democrats who want to strengthen the party's appeal to working-class voters to embrace Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal-style populist economic policies that change people's lives.
The piece that I wrote for Salon started off as I was taking a look at progressivism versus populism, going back historically to look at how that had come through. Because Trump is doing this return to the Gilded Age thing. And so it kind of sparked my interest and went back and looked a little bit at how the progressives came to kind of turn back that populist fervor that was happening in the around the turn of the century. And they put a lot of faith in expertise, professionalism, technocratic ability. And that kind of became the signature of the left, and particularly the Democratic Party. And when FDR came in, he adopted all that. He hired very, very highly skilled people to work on the problems, the vast problems that he was facing. I mean, this was the Great Depression, right? And it was, an absolutely terrible thing, and big things had to be done. And so he put people in charge who knew what they were doing, who understood the problem and had ideas about how to fix them. He went back to a previous incarnation of the Democratic Party, which was a ruthless, very hyper-partisan form of politics. And he was unafraid. He took on the right without any kind of hesitation and ended up combining those two things, the two parts of the Democratic Party, which had been before progressivism and then progressivism itself, and combined it with a ruthlessness to get things done for the good of the American people. And that's what I think that the Democrats have if they choose to go that path. That's the New Deal model, which is that, yes, you know how to do things. You have policies, you've got plans, you've got all those things that need to be done, and everybody knows it. But at the same time, you've got to be a ruthless political animal who is willing to take on the opposition, which in that case was the Great Depression, and then the literal fascists, the Nazis in World War II. That is where the Democrats have to be. They have that model. And it worked very well for the Democrats for decades. And it wasn't until maybe the 1970s that really the whole you know, the pragmatic side of the Democratic Party kind of started to fall away, and there became this great reliance on the technocratic expertise. And that is where we find this kind of stale, tepid inability to kind of recognize the foe that we have here in this new MAGA Republican Party. And if they can recapture that, if they can find it, and I think there are signs now that they're seeing that, we're starting to see some life. People like Gavin Newsom or J.B. Pritzker or Wes Moore in Maryland. There are people who are seeing this, and I am just crossing my fingers and hopeful that that's the direction they're going to take.
And Heather, I did want to mention here that for years, the Democratic Party has relied on Wall Street, large corporations, and Silicon Valley campaign cash. And it seems to be a major obstacle to adopting a truly progressive popular policy agenda, such as Medicare for all or housing as a human right. And then, of course, breaking with the fossil fuel industry to challenge corporate polluters causing the climate crisis and destroying our environment. Do you see that yourself as an impediment to the Democratic Party really going where it needs to go to win over voters who really have been hurt by the neoliberal politics practiced both by Democrats and Republicans?
There's no doubt about it. And what we're seeing laid out on a silver platter for the Democrats to just pick up and run with is this idea of, you know, that the billionaires, which, you know, are represent, you can use Donald Trump as the best example of it, as your great illustration, and all the rest of them who have basically distorted our politics and our society in general. And this is the argument. This is the campaign argument that they have waiting for them. It's right there. It couldn't be more obvious. And yes, it requires them to eschew those policies and that kind of centrist twaddle that they've been using for the last several decades. And they have to go in a more populist, working class kind of direction. But here it is. It's presented to them. It's right there. This is FDR and his four freedoms. This is him saying, you know, these are my enemies. I welcome their hatred. You know, that's the kind of thing that they have to embrace. I think, I mean, don't you? When you look at the last election and with the concerns that people had and what everybody was going through and the way our economy is leaving, you know, vast numbers of people behind, particularly young people, I don't think there's any doubt that the people will respond to this. Somebody just has to take the chance of just going after it and being as unabashed as FDR was when he did that.
That was Salon columnist and Hullabaloo blogger Heather Digby Parton. Find a link to her recent commentary titled Paging FDR, Democrats Need to Embrace New Deal-Style Politics, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Most of the immigrants being deported from the U.S. by the Trump regime today are Latine, from Mexico or Central America. But many immigrants from other nations live in the U.S., and their stories are not often heard. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Tabitha Sudeo, Executive Director of Connecticut Students for a Dream, which works mostly with young immigrants. Sudeo herself is West Indian, and she recently convened a meeting in Hamden, Connecticut, to bring together Black immigrants from various countries to discuss their experiences and how they might increase collaboration with others at risk of abduction and deportation by ICE agents under Trump's oppressive policies. In Connecticut, for example, Jamaicans are on the list of top 10 nations whose citizens are targeted for deportation. Here, Sudeo talks about the differing experiences of African Americans and other members of the African diaspora, whose lives were shaped in distinct ways by European colonizers from England, France, and the Netherlands.
I'm originally from Guyana in South America, and I grew up on the island of St. Martin. And as I have been in the organizing field, especially in the immigrant organizing field, there is a lot of comfort in organizing, especially with immigrant rights in Spanish-speaking communities, and really not as much within West Indian communities, right? Because of course, there are Black folks who are Latino, for instance, right? But then also you have this other subsection of folks from the Caribbean and folks from South America who might be English speaking, they might be French speaking, they might be Dutch speaking, and they don't necessarily have access to the same types of resources. One or two, there might not be as much of an intentional way of doing outreach in the community. And so it was something that was really important to me because of my own personal background and from things that I've seen on the ground as well.
I mean, are you in touch with a lot of immigrants who fit that description, who are not Spanish speaking?
Black immigrants, absolutely, absolutely. There are also lots of Congolese and Sudanese and Jamaicans and Trinidadians and Guyanese folk here, right, in the United States, especially here in Connecticut. And so we did have a great turnout and folks did show up. A lot of our conversation had to do with the differences between African-American and Black immigrant communities and how can we sort of reconcile some of those differences and to just really have an honest conversation about it. Because as we know, as we see on the ground, there are folks who are undocumented, but every day the statuses continue to dwindle. And that undocumented community in the state is getting larger and larger and larger and capturing more and more people. So we have to have these conversations. And it's also about equity, right? And making sure that folks have what they need. We know that Black immigrants are disproportionately arrested by police, but also we see similar trends with immigration enforcement too.
What trend exactly are you seeing there?
Folks being actually detained, right? Because throughout the nation, you see increased interaction with police, right? If you're Black, period, whether if you're an immigrant, whether if you're here from the United States, and there is a prison to deportation pipeline that also exists here in this country. In Connecticut, we do have the Trust Act, right? That prevents a certain level of interaction with the police. But at the end of the day, we still see these trends. Within my culture, I think within West Indian culture particularly, there is this cultural sentiment that you keep your business at home, you don't speak about it, don't talk about your status, don't talk about the issues that you're going through. And that really flies in the face of organizing when you are leaning upon your direct experiences. And so I think a lot of it too is it's a cultural shift too.
Do you see the same issues around the country, not just in Connecticut?
I think it's throughout the United States, I would say. There is an incredible organization that's called UndocuBlock. And so they focus on the issues of Black undocumented immigrants, and they do a great job. They're in DC, but they have chapters across the nation. And then there is another organization that's called VAGI, that stands for the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. And so they do a lot of work around, you know, racial justice as it intersects with immigration. But besides these two organizations, there are not that many large orgs that focus on these issues, but the issues persist. They persist throughout the nation.
You had mentioned earlier that it was important to have a conversation between Black immigrants and African Americans, people who were born here, because there were some differences. Can you say more about that?
When we talk about race, it's a huge topic. And so whenever we're talking about race within America, there is a difference, right, in the ways that anti-Black racism shows itself. And so anti-Black racism as a global concept, I think, is quite understood. But in America, there's a specific white-Black duality that is quite different than the rest of the world. And I think also compared to the Caribbean and to South America. And by that, I mean, there are more nuances, perhaps, that we talk about in the Caribbean. At times, we can other each other, whether if it's the African community to Caribbean Black community or to Black Caribbean community to the African American community. And so it's really just a larger conversation to be had that is incredibly nuanced and that we don't really have a lot of space to do so. And so we partnered with the African American Society, and so much of this work is doing that and to delve into those issues.
That was Tabitha Sudeo, Executive Director of Connecticut Students for a Dream. Learn more about efforts to build bridges between diverse immigrant communities by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Trump-appointed Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced on August 5th the cancellation of nearly $500 million in federal funding for mRNA vaccine research and development. The funding cut will terminate 22 active research projects focusing on mRNA vaccines targeting respiratory illnesses. RFK Jr., a longtime opponent of vaccines and spreader of health-related disinformation, offered only a vague rationale for this dramatic shift in U.S. vaccine research, claiming that mRNA technology poses more risks than benefits for respiratory viruses. Infectious disease experts condemned Kennedy's decision, maintaining that mRNA technology used in vaccines is safe, and credit its development with slowing the 2020 coronavirus pandemic that killed more than 1.1 million Americans. Future pandemics, they warned, will be harder to stop without the help of mRNA. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Farrick Fong, professor of laboratory medicine, pathology, and microbiology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Here he discusses the deadly consequences of ending mRNA research for U.S. and global public health that will undermine our ability to respond quickly to dangerous future pandemics.
There's virtually no credible organizations of physicians, virologists, public health experts who think this was a good decision. There's editorials in all the major scientific journals saying this is a disastrous decision that will place the country and the world at risk. Many medical associations have entered in joint statements to say what a ridiculously poor decision this is. It's the worst decision made by the Trump administration in the areas of health, according to many people. And a group of 80 expert virologists in the field have written to affirm their support for continuing the use and development of these vaccines. So I think what we need at this point is a united public response to try to get RFK Jr. to reverse this decision. He's clearly over his head in this position. He's been pursuing this anti-vax agenda and also a lot of other things which are not really scientifically evidence-based. And he's been neglecting important threats that the country is facing that should be in his purview. And he's now going to delay research progress and leave us poorly prepared for the next pandemic, which will inevitably come at some point. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are calling for his removal. That could be very challenging. But at the very least, I think it's important to put pressure on the government to reverse a bad decision before it's too late. I think it's still not too late to try to resume some of this research and get things back on track. But, you know, science and public health are facing a lot of different threats from the administration of all different kinds. And I think people are feeling a little bit overwhelmed. My colleagues I know, you know, who were already hit pretty hard by the emotional toll of the long hours and the stress of having patients so severely ill and sometimes dying from infection, and felt really relieved to get through the pandemic, only to find that we're actually, as a country, in worse shape than before in terms of people's information about public health and preparation moving forward. I think everybody is in the public health field is really shocked by this.
Dr. Fong, you've talked about the loss to our country and the world in terms of valuable research. Some of that research, of course, we will need in the event of future pandemics, of which you said we can count on one coming. You've concluded that this cancellation of this research will result in people dying. Just say a quick word about that, if you would.
Well, I hate to be overly dramatic, but I don't think it's any exaggeration to say that. There are a huge number of infections in the world, and most of them don't have vaccines, and nobody's trying to develop a vaccine because they're not that serious. We can get them, they're self-limited, and we get over it. The vaccines that have been developed are for really terrible diseases. They're diseases that can kill you. They're diseases that can be permanently disabling or cause severe lifelong complications. And so when we're talking about using this technology, we're talking about using it for some of the most serious disease threats that the world has. Not just COVID, but looking at things like AIDS or things like hemorrhagic fever viruses or, you know, other sorts of pathogens we haven't even thought about that we may encounter. Influenza has been a recurring challenge because, like COVID, it mutates frequently. And every year, you know, people probably wonder, why do I have to get a new flu shot? It's because the flu virus comes back in a different form every year. And so we're trying to develop better technologies that can develop robust responses that are more conserved against various flu strains, so that maybe we don't have to take the flu vaccine so often. mRNA technology could allow us to make the vaccine later, so we could wait to see a better idea about what this flu season was going to be comprised of in terms of those strains. And what if we get something like an avian-type flu that ends up being transmissible from person to person? We don't have immunity to that. And so it could be a disaster, but the mRNA technology could allow us to make a really rapid response to avian flu or other flu strains. You know, abandoning this technology is also going to hurt us in terms of our place in the world. When the COVID vaccine was developed, or when other breakthroughs have happened, the U.S. has often been in the lead. And so Americans are among the first to get access to these new vaccines. During COVID, you know, COVID started in China, and China was investigating it very carefully, but they developed a different kind of vaccine, a whole virus inactivated vaccine, and that vaccine technology ended up being not as effective. And when they wanted to get mRNA vaccines, you know, it was only much later that they were able to get access to it. So we're going to put our country into that position where we're no longer the ones driving the technology, and we're going to be at the back of the queue trying to get these things that everybody wants. It's really hard to comprehend why we would take this huge advantage that we've had as a scientific community and how important it's been, not just for the health of Americans, but for the economy of the country, and tear that apart the way the Trump administration is doing right now with the war on universities and on the NIH and research grants and so on. It's really unfathomable. I can't understand any good reason for it.
That was Dr. Farrick Fong, professor of laboratory medicine, pathology, and microbiology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Learn more about the dangerous consequences of the Trump regime's termination of mRNA vaccine research by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, KMUD in Eureka, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.